So, the starting again, sorry to interrupt, we were just talking and I wanted to get it on tape. But first of all, I wanted to acknowledge that we have another person present with us here today, Lini Groshinski, who is with the National Trust and is sitting in on this interview as a learning exercise and also to provide support. And in our break, she amazingly revealed that... Can you tell us the story?
When we were talking to us about her travels, she was saying that she'd gone on an Italian ship in 1964 to Europe, which made me think, I think I was on an Italian ship in Sydney in 1964. It turns out we were both sailing in 1964 on the Italian ship Galileo from Sydney, on which I went to Singapore, and she went on to Europe. So, good coincidence.
It's amazing, I don't believe it, really.
It is, it's a wonderful coincidence. So
you never know who you're going to meet.
So I did invite Lini to talk before, but I want to say you're very welcome. Please, if you have any interjections or any suggestions or thoughts or coincidences, please share them.
Thank you.
And then we were just talking about Europe, Well, just to go back to where we were talking about your trip around Europe, and you said that when you were there, you never expected to go back, so that's why you did 60,000 miles, I suppose it was, in those days.
No, it was kilometres.
It was kilometres. And so were you going to talk about that, that you met...
Well, I left Australia in 64, January 64, and I thought, well, I have to see as much of Europe as possible, so... That's why I went to as many countries in Europe and the UK. I didn't go to Ireland at that stage, though. I only went to the UK and then Europe.
And so you wanted to sort of see it all, but you said you also, when you left, you never wanted to come back too. So there's a few, like, not sure where you're going with your future.
Well, that's true. I didn't know. Well, I didn't know whether I'd get a job somewhere or whether I'd have to come home or what. Mm. So, luckily, I did get a job with Chamberlain, Powell and Bond in London, finally. And I was there about 8 months. That was really good. But I've already talked about that. So.
A little bit, but not for how long. And so why did you... decide to come back to Sydney at that time then? Or did you?
After I left Chamberlain, Powell & Bond, I went to Scandinavia by myself, and then I said to somebody else, a friend who I'd met, that I'd meet them in Rome. So I had to get at a certain time, so I had to go to Scandinavia and see whatever else I want to see them, get back to there in time to do that. He was a doctor who'd been on the boat with Philip, actually.
So Philip came over to Europe at that time as well?
Yes.
And did you meet up with him?
I met up with him, and we all shared an apartment in London, with Gary and Carol Seddon. Gary was an architect. And it was Michael, the man whose mothers do have them, guys. It was his flat. What's his name? Michael, the comedian guy who sings as well.
No. Was he in the showbiz at that time? Were you?
Yeah,
you?
Yeah.
Oh.
And we stayed in his flat, and then I left them and went off to Scandinavia by myself because I wanted to see everything. I'm an Alvar Aalto fan, and I really wanted to go to Finland.
And did you?
Of course.
And you didn't go and introduce yourself to him, knock on his door?
Oh yes, the office of. So I met Mrs. Aalto, whatever her name is, and I'd got a connection from someone in Chamberlain, Powell & Bond in the office who worked thing, and they then so I connected to the office, and the, some of the young people in the office asked me to go and have dinner with them, and I did that, and it was lovely. Then I just drove all over Finland to see as many of his buildings as possible. And then I went to Sweden and started, and then I went back to Denmark and I started coming down again to Italy.
So can I ask, when you left university, you would have had some sort of vision of a career for yourself, I suppose. And what was that? And then how did this trip to Europe kind of impact on what you thought you would like to do in the world?
I didn't really know what I would like to do. I just knew I'd now graduated in architecture. I'd registered as an architect.
Immediately?
And it cost, after, as soon as I graduated and got the piece of paper, I went to the Board of Architects and registered. It cost £5. Mm. I didn't have to do any exams or anything. I was not fit to be an architect. I knew absolutely nothing about building. But then I went and worked for Pedlethorpe and Walker for a year. And then I left and went to Europe because I had always wanted to go. My parents talked about their 2 years in London in the 30s after they got married, and you know, I learned about all European architecture and I wanted to see whether it was new or ancient or whatever. That was fantastic.
And so you did still see sort of having a career as an architect in some respect.
Yeah.
And how was Pedlethorpe and Walker in terms of getting you started?
Well, I didn't know much and I had to learn on the job.
Were they helpful?
Yes. Yeah.
And I suppose Thorpe and Walker were, were they all in the office? Were they
Pedlethorpe still wasn't there. Graham Thorpe was running the practice, and one of the Frank Thorpe was around. Well, no, SG was around. No, Graham's father was there too.
Would he have been original?
Yes. Oh. He was a nice little guy. He was little. and SG Thorpe had built a house called Pebbles in Shellcove Road, Neutral Bay, which is opposite a house my grandmother and grandfather built, where my father and his brother grew up before things. Yes, somehow. I don't know. I can't remember. I'm not sure of the timing.
So the family sort of knew each other a little?
Yeah. Mm.
And what about going to Europe then? Did that change your vision of architecture, like what architecture could be? Did you expect it? You already knew?
I don't know. I knew I had to learn lots of things because I knew nothing. I wasn't very good at three dimensions either. And I didn't know how to build. But you learn things and you pick up stuff and you realise. When I worked in Chamberlain Power and Bond, I realised I did know a few things, and I did, worked on the physics building.
Mm.
And
what was
all the construction details and things.
What was the physics building? I'm not familiar.
They were doing a whole campus of new buildings.
The London,
Leeds, sorry, University of Leeds. Sorry. Right. Mm. And just before I left, one of the guys took me up to Leeds to have a look, which is great, just to the campus. So then I knew what I was, you know, what the context was like.
Mm.
Otherwise, I was just a drafts person in the office.
Yeah, you've got to see the real context, don't you? So, it sounds like you have real interest in modernist architectural design, but you also had a long-standing interest in history and heritage. So how did those two interests work together?
Well, they were private, really. I mean, you know, the things I was doing at Pearl's Hall were different.
Like modern?
I don't know. I can't actually remember what they were.
I guess they were leading, but they weren't the leading practices in the 60s.
They were doing lots of office buildings and stuff, but I didn't work on any of them.
So you were just having a private interest in history, and I suppose heritage wasn't...
Yeah, I used to, well, I'd go... Mum would take me to these women's group inspections of houses and stuff, and I'd go along with her and look at them all, and it was very nice.
And they were National Trust?
They were all National Trust. That was the National Trust.
Well,
And so when I came back in 66, John Morris, who was running the National Trust in New South Wales at that time, decided that there were a lot of young people who were interested, and they started the junior group of the National Trust. And myself and a lot of our friends, we went out in the weekends and looked at all the buildings that we knew about, and they're all colonial stuff, and we drew them and photographed them and had picnics and whatever.
Were they mainly
and they asked us to help. Yes, they were all our university friends.
So who were they?
And some of our school friends. Who were they? Philip Cox Caroline Cullis Hill and me, and I don't know, some of Catherine Heppel is a school friend, and people like Helen Proudfoot, who we met through the National Trust somehow.
So she was one of the young crowd at that point?
Yeah, at that time. Yeah.
And was she with Peter Proudfoot, or you call that place? That's another Sydney Uni person, I think?
Yes. Peter had was our tutor in third year when I failed and had to do it again. It was good, he was very good.
He didn't dislike him because you failed.
He wasn't horrible, he didn't make rude remarks about your buildings, he was helpful.
That's good. And Clive Lucas would have been in that
Clive,
group.
Clive, yes, but he was younger, so yes.
He was younger than you?
Yeah.
He was already very expert, I think, about historic buildings, because he'd been fascinated ever since he was a child, from what I understand.
Well, you know more than I do. I don't know. But then other people like Howard Tanner and John Richardson in later times started doing things with the National Trust, and then I also joined the historic Buildings Committee, the New South Wales chapter of the Royal Australian Institute of Architects, in 1966.
Oh, so the Institute had its own historic...
Yeah,
sort of
it had one since the 1950s.
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
And Peter Phillips' father was on it. All Phillips was on it. And Peter Bridges, and we met all these people.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it was really good.
Were they...
And I'm still on the committee. I refuse to leave because I know too much now.
Were they compiling a register back
yes,
in those early
yes,
days? Some of those early days.
There's 4,000 at least items on the register. It's still not all right. And still, you know, there's hard. We haven't got even a sheet on each building. It's on, I shouldn't say that.
No, I'm aware of that.
No,
it's mainly a name and an address,
but
it's better than nothing.
The latest members of the committee are really good. They're all very keen at the moment, so they've been doing all last year. It wasn't 2023. They've been doing a lot of buildings, and the institute is looking at bibliographies of the architects, updating all of those because they're either out of date or there's a name and nothing else. And that's just as important.
Anne Hine did a huge amount.
Yeah, Noni did a lot.
And Noni Boyd.
And then Michael didn't do much, Michael Gunn,
Michael
and then
Gunn.
We lost a sponsorship from the Heritage Council.
We
haven't had it back.
It's a shame because it was a role, I think it was 2 or 3 days a week, for someone to look after that, and for about 10 or 15 years, and they did a huge
amount.
They
did a lot of work and was really good. But that's another story.
Yes, it is.
Go
right,
on
so
with that through.
So there were two, were there any other history heritage groups that you got involved with in the 60s?
No,
that
was enough.
That
I was
a
working. When I came back, I had to get a job, so I still couldn't get a job. I had to go back to Pettleford and walk and ask Graham Thorpe if he'd give me a job, and he said, well, I hope you're better than you were last time.
Oh!
I said, I want to go on site. I wanted a site job this time.
Good. And did he give you one?
Yeah. So then I had to... The Australasian Pioneers Club had a building in York Street, I think it was, and they wanted to be fixed up, so I worked on that and we did it and everything for them.
Was that like a renovation?
It was a renovation.
Or a conservation? Like
and it had ironstone, not sandstone, ironstone down the bottom. We had hell trying to dig it out. Jackhammer it all out. I forget what we were doing. I think we were doing something with the lifts.
You mean natural ironstone in the...
Yes, it's as hard as hell. There's a bit just next door here.
Oh.
It's really hard to cut through it.
Wow.
You don't want to have an excavation site with that in there if you can avoid it.
Right. And so is that building still there?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh.
Get
Maybe not. Oh, I'm just not familiar. So,
they're not there. I don't know where they sold the building to someone. I forget.
Did you have any sort of heritage principles with you as you were working on this building, or was it
no.
just felt like it was just you could do whatever you wanted?
I was just doing an upgrade of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I can't remember exactly, but I think the lifts there were originally on the pumping station hydro system that was on the edge of Darling Harbour, and we had to do something with the lift shafts, and we had to fix the kitchens, and we had to fix up the outside, and do all these other bits and pieces inside the thing.
Mm.
Because it was a club, and they had club rooms and food and things like that there. I did that for a while.
It's nice to have your own project rather than being under other people. And so how long did you stay working with Pebble Thorpe and Walker?
That was 66. I stayed till June 68. And I've been working on the AJC grandstand at Randwick and the bars out there and the judges box and the new roof and all that sort of stuff.
And again, was that the historic structure that's out there?
No.
So it was a new one?
It was a new building.
Mm-hmm. But you are working in a very historic environment, another
It has nothing to do with that. And then I went to McConnell Smith and Johnson. I managed to get a job there.
And you liked, that was a firm that you admired and wanted to work with? Great.
Then I stayed there for nearly 30 years.
Well.
Did most of my professional life out of there.
Right.
So that was good.
So what kind of things did you do there? Tell us a bit
about
that.
Well, I did some heritage stuff there in the beginning, but in the end I ended up doing hospitals for the government. I mean, working on hospitals for the government.
The Stevenson and Turner did lots of those in the mid-20th century.
Yeah, and then we took over.
Right.
And I didn't like it. We started at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. We got that and they didn't, so that was a bit of a problem.
Because they had designed some of those major buildings there.
Well, their people, yes.
Now, I'll just interrupt. So Stevenson and Turner had a good record of employing women architects. So was McConnell, Smith and Johnson, was there an issue about you being a woman, or was it just normal for them?
Yeah. I think we got less than the boys, huh?
Hmm.
And salary-wise, I mean, like...
It's still happening.
I know. Anyway, that's beside the point. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, tell us a bit about the 30 years that you spent there. That's sort of a substantial part of anyone's career.
Yeah, well, we did some work in the box. We did some work on the roof of Trinity Church down there.
Oh.
We fixed up the slate roof.
Oh. The one on
Argyle Place.
Argyle Place. Oh. That's an 1850s stone church.
I made the boys go up the ladders to inspect it.
Because you're wearing a dress? Or just because you didn't like heights?
I don't mind heights, but I did a lot of inspections, but in the end I made them do it. It's good, well, they had to do it, learn too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was sort of conservation stuff with the slate roof.
Were you using those principles that the Borough Charter later kind of made formalised?
No, I never know anything. I didn't belong to ICOMOS or anything.
Well, it wasn't a thing until 76. No, it didn't become a thing until 97.
No, you just intuitively did try to do the right thing, to fix it up and make it like it was, to make the building waterproof.
And try and keep as much of the original fabric as possible and reuse things rather than...
The slates deteriorate, so you had to get some new ones.
Mm. And try and get the same
colour and everything else. Do the same pattern if there was a pattern.
Mm. Common sense in
the
way.
Make sure all the box gutters were clean and worked and rainwater heads worked. Mm. And it's really, maintenance, quite frankly.
Mm.
So we did a few little bits down there. And I like doing heritage. When I first went to MSJ, I was employed to work on the Commonwealth State Law Courts.
So that's a modern, that was a modern building between Phillip and Macrosia that was just being built at that time?
Yeah. So we were documenting all of that.
Wow, that's very beautiful building.
Mm. So that was from 68 to about 72. And I was in charge of detailing. Well, I had to learn how to detail by that stage. And I remember having to do research on how... It's a steel frame building. And it's over the railway line.
The tunnel into
over the city circle.
Ah.
And one of the columns has to sit on this rubber thing.
Because of the bumping of the trains.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
I had to do all the research on how to fire rate the steelwork. Because no one had done enough research on steel itself at that stage, and we had to put stuff on it to make sure it was okay, and we weren't going to encase it in concrete. So we did that. I worked on all the internal details of that thing, and it was also because it was courtrooms. We had to do a hell of a lot about acoustics between rooms and everything. So that was, I had to learn how to do all that from the acoustic engineers. And then we had the program. I never worked with a programmer before. We had to program how to document it all.
An IT programmer? Or no, it's an architectural term, is it?
Well, yeah. We had Tracy Brunstrom and Hammond who were the consultants. And I had to work with them on how to program all the documentation and get it all done in time for whatever it was.
Right, so it's not IT.
IT didn't exist.
No, yet. Not. What year are we talking? The late
68.
68.
At that stage, I was learning on how to write a program using whatever it was, zero and one.
So now you are talking IT.
IT was just starting, and no one knew anything about it. And I actually could do that kind of program. But when it came to computers, I had no idea and I still don't understand it.
I mean, they were actually using IT at that time to build the Sydney Opera House, I think. But it was in its
no,
very
they weren't.
Early. I'm not understanding.
That was the whole problem. They didn't have IT. You want me to start on the Opera House?
I know. Ashworth
took us down there in third year, 51 years ago.
So that's about 1960?
1959.
Being built around 57 and went through to 73, so it was being built this entire period. It still was in its design stage in 60, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. So he was on the jury, and he was very proud of it, and he took us down there. We were very lucky.
Mm.
And it was all the foundations of the building and things and on the site coming out of the ground. That was that bit. And they, Arabs were talking about how the rock anchors in those big beams that go over the car entry at the underneath the steps, the major steps, how the rock anchors near Government House weren't working properly, and they didn't know what they were going to do anyway. They must sort it out because it's built and it's been there for 50 years.
And they took a few years to get it right.
So that was interesting. I've followed the Opera House, building of the Opera House, ever since. In fact, I came back from Europe just in time in March 1966 to march up from the Opera House where Harry Seiler made a speech, where the photographer Michael something also made a speech, and we all marched up to Parliament House
and to protest the fact that Auckland had been
gone. I went to the meeting in the lower town hall where the institute talked about him going and what they were going to do, and
I was going to ask you to get involved in, because architects were a major part of that protest lobby, I think.
Absolutely. And the competition, it was an International Union of Architects competition, which was very important, a world competition. It was in 1956, and it was at the end of 56, January 57, I can't remember which, they announced that Ulton had won it, and I was working for Arnold Engineering and Lifts in Chippendale, sorting the bolts for the lifts they made. They did all the little lifts for the Snow Mountain scheme and stuff. And I got teased like hell because I was just working in the drafting office or doing odd jobs, and the guy said, you know, do you want to be an architect and build these mad things like this design? And they teased me like mad.
Because you were just a beginning architect.
I hadn't even started. I was about to start in March 57.
Mm. It did look outlandish, the original.
Well, it was very different. But if they'd built the second one, which was were boxes on top of each other, it was the most boring, terrible, really horrible stuff.
Yeah, it was really courageous of Cahill to go with the Premier
Look to your car.
I'll wait. Okay. We'll risk
a pick. But can I say, my understanding was that Arabs I've heard a number of stories where Arabs were calling London every day during the construction phase and the...
They were using slide rules. One of the boys on the boat, the Marconi, went and worked for Arabs, and they were using slide rules. They didn't have...
But they were making phone calls every day to London, which had the only really decent computer in the world, and getting computer...
Well,
kind
I
of
didn't
things.
Know that.
Well, there was a woman at Wilson's, wasn't a funeral, it was a tribute to Wilson after he died, who was the secretary, talking about how she took these calls every morning and sort of wrote down all the figures for Arabs to use to help design the concrete as it was being constructed.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was apparently the first building in the world to be... have computers in the use of the
well,
and
yeah,
it couldn't have been
built
without
very sophisticated at that stage.
No, they wouldn't have been. It was incredible.
Because the first computer I saw at Sydney University was made of radio valves. And it was in the electrical engineering thing that guy who influenced me to go to Sydney University, David Myers. He had this thing in the electrical engineering faculty because I went to see him. He said, you've got to come and see me when you come to the university. So I went to see him. He showed me all this stuff, and it was just, you could hardly use a calculator. We didn't have calculators.
No. You couldn't imagine where that was going to go within your...
Well, we did everything in architectural science with bloody slide rules and... I like everything to line up and work, and you can't get it that accurate that things meet each other. Like a drawing, you can't do that either.
Wow, really?
So that was frustrating. But I don't know the history of computers. You're probably quite right.
Only because I was at that... I mean, I worked on the Opera House for a year.
Did you?
Project managing the World Heritage nomination for the Heritage Office.
Yes.
And that's why I got an invite to that thing. But that wasn't really in the literature. It wasn't well known, that stuff.
There's
about...
lots of things not in the literature.
Lots of things are still coming out. It's amazing. Yeah. So...
Like the journalist when I was in Paris wanting to have a look at all the Opera House documents that we had, and I just said to the staff, you're not letting anyone near that. Not when I was president of the UIA, and I didn't want anything blowing up when I was a president. I don't know what's in the box.
What year was that?
I don't know, between 2008 and 2011.
And it was a German, you said, that you were worried about?
A journalist.
A journalist, just a journalist. No.
I thought, no, they're not digging around there. I said, just say, well, I don't know where they are. They're somewhere in the archives, and it's at some other place. And
so where was this box?
It's in Paris.
In Paris?
Well, the International Union of Architects' office is in Paris.
Uh-huh. So why do they have to...
Because it was the UIA competition for the Opera House.
So they kept all the records from that competition?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what they kept. I didn't look in the boxes. I never saw one.
Mm.
I have no idea what they've got in there.
Wow.
But all the controversy and stuff would have... They've got stuff on all that too.
Mm-hmm.
I think... But I never saw it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to know.
It's an archivist job. Or a historian. So, to get back to McConnell, Smith and Johnson, what were some of your other favourite jobs that you did with them? And that's one question I want to ask. And the other was, it seems like by this stage you're beginning to... what did you see as your attributes as an architect? What parts of architecture did you feel really good about?
Well, because I married Philip and he's a design architect and I'm not, I decided I'd have to do administration and building and all the other stuff. So that's what I concentrated on at McConnell, Smith and Johnson.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. On how you build the building and why you build the building, and does it work, is it suitable for the occupant, and
you know, it's all
is it environmental, is the PowerPoints in the right place in the operating theatre, does the you know, where does the gas come from, all that practical stuff, which is because I spent about 25 years working on hospitals there. You have to build it so that it works for the doctors and nurses and the staff.
So it's the less glamorous side of architecture, but also incredibly practical and also constantly changing. Like you would have to keep researching and keep abreast of the changing technologies.
Yeah. By the time we I worked 13 years on Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, E Block. By the time we finished it, the room for all the telecommunications and telephones and stuff, communication, that had changed. We had, instead of rows of racks and racks and racks, an enormous thing, they had a little box in the middle of this enormous room.
Because electronic technology had become
completely
so
changed.
Micro, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, you had to deal with that. We built that as a concrete building on the outside, and all the internal partitions were lightweight steel with plasterboard or something walls. So you had to deal with acoustics, you had to deal with wet stuff, you had to deal with everything. But it was great because you could put all, because it was hollow, and we used steel studs. And sometimes timber studs, you could run all the services in the walls, and if you want to put in a new service, you just cut a hole in the plasterboard, put it in, and then you put the plaster back and set it and paint it, and you didn't know. It was fantastic. It's the best way of building I know. So I'd learned all the acoustics from the Commonwealth State Law Courts, and so it was easy for me to detail these hospitals as I don't really had the knowledge. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had acoustic engineers on that too, but at least I knew what I was doing that time. I didn't have to learn it.
Mm. I would imagine working in that side of the architecture field, it'd be a constant learning experience.
Absolutely.
Trying to keep up with, especially hospitals, the technologies are changing so fast all the time around the world.
We had nurse planners and doctor planners to tell us what had to go into the thing, and they didn't understand any of the technology of the stuff that had to go in it. We had to find out.
Mm.
And then you had to squash it into the building or the room or whatever. Many of the time they said, oh, it's just five little bottles on the wall, but they didn't tell me it needed a huge water tank that had to all be filtered through these five bottles, and you had to put the tank somewhere in a laboratory that was already full of other stuff. Anyway.
And I imagine too.
And you had to have a pump because, you know, to make it work.
A pump?
Well, you had to pump the water.
Pump.
It doesn't just go uphill with you.
Well, and I imagine too, you would have been aware that this is a quite fine building at Prince Alfred, so you didn't want to be demolishing stuff willy-nilly to make room for this stuff. You would have been trying to fit it all in.
Absolutely. And it was state-of-the-art, and that was a, you know, they got the latest of everything. I really liked it. It was a joint job with the Public Works and McCall, Smith & Johnson. It was joint. We did it together. It wasn't them sitting on top of us. We had to agree.
So you're working with the Government Architects Office?
Yes.
So you got to know them?
That was interesting too.
Because that was one of the, I think, the great workplaces in the mid-20th century for architects to learn their trade.
But we, you know, they had to work with their engineers and the consulting engineers and all that stuff. So I did lots of those jobs. We did a joint job with the Cox office on a hospital in Malaysia. which was an Australian government turnkey project where we had to build and run the hospital and equip it for 2 years afterwards up in Malaysia.
It's a form of aid?
It was very interesting.
And you thought Cox was working in a separate company?
Yeah.
His own company but you're working...
We had to work with them and the locals. We had the local component because we didn't know local building requirements or the local fire brigade requirements or how the water got from A to B and X, Y and Z. We had to work on all these things. So there were three of us working on I enjoyed all those kind of things. It was all liaison, listen, find out and make sure it worked.
Mm. Was that your first kind of major job overseas, like trying to work from Australia on an overseas site?
That was mine, yeah.
Mm.
I used to go up there every 3 months to see if they were doing the right thing.
Mm.
And they did build it on a palm oil plantation and the ground level had to be raised a metre because it flooded. When the local river rose, the site flooded. And we had to build all the housing for the nurses and doctors as well.
And that would be different design to Australian housing, I guess.
Yeah, it was all because of the climate, and it was all naturally ventilated. They didn't air condition anything except the theatres. So you had to, make sure. And it also, that was very... Phillip's office and us, we had to be sympathetic to the local architecture. I mean local, not the indigenous stuff. And people had to like the hospital because before that they had high-rise English design hospitals. And everyone went there to jump off the building to commit suicide because the locals were very scared of going to hospital. They thought they were going to die if they had to go to a hospital because they didn't understand anything like that. And we had to build something that didn't look like that or feel like that. So at the end, when the local head of the state, whatever he was, said, "It looks like a Club Med," I was really happy. I thought, we've actually achieved the thing that we needed to. And also, it was a place where they bring the family. I mean, you get the bed and the mattress, but they don't provide sheets or anything. And they have to bring the food.
Wow, it's a different culture.
Very interesting, and the culture was completely different as well. So we had to understand the culture, we had to understand the local building methods, and we had to, because it was a turnkey project, we were supposed to leave a legacy of what we'd done to the local architects and the builders and etc. etc.
Sounds like you did.
We did, but we also realised that the only way we had to use very simple building techniques, and we had to build out of the materials that they had. And
which would make it a lot more cheap.
And it was much easier. You couldn't use sophisticated glass and steel and stuff. Brick and plaster walls and tile roofs and timber trusses and stuff like that.
Mm.
And then you had, because of the heat, you had to have shading devices on the windows, but they also stopped people jumping because they couldn't get out, so it was interesting.
What was the name of this hospital and where was it?
Telak Intan District Hospital.
Telak Intan. Near Kuala Lumpur?
It's a 5-hour drive north.
Oh. Is it still there?
I hope so.
Be interesting to find out.
Last time I went there was a 89.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Is it 35 years?
Mm-hmm. I mean, hopefully it's still there. Anyway.
That's an amazing example of, you know, architecture just doesn't get enough credit for that kind of broad-based kind of engagement with the site. It's all the glamorous buildings that seems to get all the attention, but there's so much of this kind of work being done.
Well, only 1% of the building is design. The rest, how do you build it and make it stand up? How does it last for more than 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm. How does it
last for 100 years, etc., etc., etc.?
Now, I want to say that in a previous conversation, you've told me that you were somehow working for the City of Sydney and helped compile their first heritage list in around about 1971. Can you tell me about that and where it fitted into this part of your career?
I got sick of architecture, so we had another firm called MSJ Keyes Young that did planning and stuff like that, that Peter Keyes ran with other people, and I said I was sick of the whatever I was doing, and this is before the hospitals, and so the city of Gazzard, Clark Gazzard and the Omens were doing a whole master plan for the city.
Oh.
And they had all these sub areas that they were looking at, and MSJ Keyes Young got the whatever it was preservation thing of the city. So I had to go and do the survey of all the buildings in the city of Sydney.
Wow.
I've got some of it upstairs. So I kept a copy of it.
Do you have the list, that original list you compiled?
Yes.
Wow. I would love to see that.
I don't know where it is. I know, well, I can show you something. So, the City Council used to have these meetings about the heritage and stuff and how you're getting on and what you were doing, and I used to have to go and sit in the meeting and tell them where we were up to, and show them the list, and we gave them the list, and then they were too terrified to adopt it.
So it may not be on the public record, the list, because of that.
Yeah, I don't know what, I forget.
Might have got lost.
Then, as well as that, I once did a thing on the QVB too, for conserving the stone or whatever it was. We had to do the thing on that too.
It was that much later?
No. It was around 1970.
Wasn't the QVB under huge risk of being demolished for a car park? So was that the same time?
Yeah.
Like when was it? The QVB being a magnificent Victorian sort of market building in the middle of the city, it takes up a whole block, and now it's one of our favourite sort of...
Yes, I know, but it was something. The Electricity Commission or something was in half of it, and the other was bits and pieces.
Was it owned by the city?
Yes.
Oh. And so it was under, you know, there was talk about demolition for a car park, and then there was another huge eruption of heritage action around it.
Then was it Epo Gardens or whatever they were called? They did a scheme to turn it into a shopping centre, and then it was much better.
And were you involved in any, what was your involvement along all of that pathways?
Trying to get them to agree to pay fixing up the stonework.
To keep it and fix it.
There's a spiral stair that goes up into the dome that wasn't fixed at the top. So you go up there and, you know, you're floating around in mid-air. I'm sure someone's connected it to the stonework now.
Was it metal? That's why it had that amount of give. Was it a metal spiral stair?
Yes, it was nice. It was a cast iron Wow. Balustrade thing.
Wow.
So that was all related to something.
Well, look, I think we're getting a bit tired. I think we should have a little... I think let's call this to an end today. And because I would love to talk to you about, you know, we've still got heaps to go
I
in terms
go
of your work.
Years.
I think you do. So let's have
I can tell you about the 50 cities I've visited or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. And I'd love to hear about you becoming the first woman president of the Institute of Architects in New South Wales and Australia and the International Union of Architects. So I think you're the second woman in the International Union, but the first Australian.
Yes.
President. So I'd love to talk more about that. So let's call it a day today, and thank you so much for
pleasure
to pick your brain.
Do you want